When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Chapter 5 of All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque, translated by Arthur Wesley Ween. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5. Killing each separate louse is a tedious business when a man has hundreds. The little beasts are hard, and the everlasting cracking with one's fingernails very soon becomes wearisome. So Tjaden has rigged up the lid of a boot-polish tin with a piece of wire over the lighted stump of a candle. The lice are simply thrown into this little pan. Crack, and they're done for. We sit around with our shirts on our knees, our bodies naked to the warm air, and our hands at work. Haya has a particularly fine brand of louse. They have a red cross on their heads. He suggests that he brought them back with him from the hospital at Touro, where they attended personally on a surgeon general. He says he means to use the fat that slowly accumulates in the tin lid for polishing his boots, and roars with laughter for half an hour at his own joke. But he hasn't much success today. We are too preoccupied with another affair. The rumor has materialized. Himmelstoss has come. He appeared yesterday. We've already heard the well-known voice. He seems to have overdone it with a couple of young recruits on the plowed field at home, and unknown to him, the son of the local magistrate was watching. That cooked his goose. He will meet some surprises here. Tjaden has been meditating for hours what to say to him. Haya gazes thoughtfully at his great paws and winks at me. The thrashing was the high watermark of his life. He tells me he often dreams of it. Kropp and Müller are amusing themselves. From somewhere or other, probably the Pioneer Cookhouse, Kropp has bagged for himself a mess tin full of beans. Müller squints hungrily into it, but checks himself and says, "Albert, what would you do if it were suddenly peacetime again?" "There won't be any civil life," says Albert bluntly. "Well, but if," persists Müller, "what would you do?" "Clear out of this," growls Kropp. "Of course. And then what?" "Get drunk," says Albert. "Don't talk rot. I mean seriously." "So do I," says Kropp. "What else should a man do?" Cat becomes interested. He levies tribute on Kropp's tin of beans, swallows some, then considers for a while and says, "You might get drunk first, of course, but then you take the next train for home and mother. Peacetime, man, Albert." He fumbles in his oilcloth pocketbook for a photograph and suddenly shows it all round. "My old people." Then he puts it back and swears, "Damn lousy war." "It's all very well for you to talk," I tell him. "You've a wife and children." "True," he nods, "and I have to see to it that they've something to eat." We laugh. "They won't lack for that, Cat. You'd scrounge it from somewhere." Müller is insatiable and gives himself no peace. He wakes Hyavestus out of his dream. "Haya, what would you do if it was peacetime?" "Give you a kick in the backside for the way you talk," I say. "How does it come about exactly?" "How does the cow shit come on the roof?" retorts Müller laconically, and turns to Hyavestus again. It is too much for Haya. He shakes his freckled head. "You mean when the war's over?" Exactly. You've said it. Well, there be women, of course, eh? Haya licks his lips. Sure. By Jove, yes, says Haya, his face melting. Then I'd grab some good buxom dame, some real kitchen wench with plenty to get hold of, you know, and jump straight into bed. Just you think, boys, a real feather bed with a spring mattress. I wouldn't put trousers on again for a week. Everyone is silent. The picture is too good. Our flesh creeps. At last, Mulder pulls himself together and says, And then what? A pause. Then Haya explains rather awkwardly, If I were a non-com, I'd stay with the Prussians and serve out my time. Haya, you've got a screw loose, surely, I say. Have you ever dug peat? He retorts good-naturedly. You try it. Then he pulls a spoon out of the top of his boot and reaches over into Krop's mess tin. It can't be worse than digging trenches, I venture. Haya chews and grins. It lasts longer, though, and there's no getting out of it either. But man, surely it's better at home. Some ways, he says, and with open mouth sinks into a daydream. You can see what he is thinking. There is the mean but little hut on the moors, the hard work on the heath from morning till night in the heat, the miserable pay, the dirty laborer's clothes. In the army, in peacetime, you've nothing to trouble about, he goes on. Your food's found every day, or else you kick up a row. You've got a bed, every week clean underwear, like a perfect gent. You do your non-com's duty, you have a good suit of clothes. In the evening, you're a free man and go off to the pub. Haya is extraordinarily set on his idea. He's in love with it. And when your 12 years are up, you get your pension and become a village bobby, and you can walk about the whole day. He's already sweating on it. And just you think how you'd be treated. Here a dram, there a pint. Everybody wants to be well in with a bobby. You'll never be a non-com, though, Haya, interrupts Cat. Haya looks at him sadly and is silent. His thoughts still linger over the clear evenings in autumn, the Sundays in the heather, the village bells, the afternoons and evenings with the servant girls, the fried bacon and barley, the carefree evening hours in the alehouse. He can't part with all these dreams so abruptly. He merely growls, What silly questions you do ask! He pulls his shirt over his head and buttons up his tunic. What would you do, Tjaden? Asks Krop. Tjaden thinks of only one thing. See to it that Himmelstoss doesn't get past me? Apparently, he would like most to have him in a cage and sail into him with a club every morning. To Krop, he says warmly, If I were in your place, I'd see to it that I became a lieutenant. Then you could grind him till the water in his backside boils. And you, Dettering? Asks Muller like an inquisitor. He's a born schoolmaster with all his questions. Dettering is sparing with his words, but on this subject he speaks. He looks at the sky and says only the one sentence, I would go straight on with the harvesting. Then he gets up and walks off. He is worried. His wife has to look after the farm. They've already taken away two of his horses. Every day he reads the papers that come, to see whether it's raining in his little corner of Oldenburg. They haven't brought the hay in yet. At this moment, Himmelstoss appears. He comes straight up to our group. Tjaden's face turns red. He stretches his length on the grass and shuts his eyes in embarrassment. Himmelstoss is a little hesitant. His gait becomes slower. Then he marches up to us. No one makes any motion to stand up. Krop looks up at him with interest. He continues to stand in front of us and wait. As no one says anything, he launches a, Well? A couple of seconds go by. Apparently, Himmelstoss doesn't quite know what to do. He would like most to set us all on the run again, but he seems to have learned already that the front line isn't a parade ground. He tries it on, though, and by addressing himself to one instead of to all of us, hopes to get some response. Crop is nearest, so he favors him. Well, you here too? But Albert's no friend of his. A bit longer than you, I fancy, he retorts. The red mustache twitches. You don't recognize me any more, what? Todd now opens his eyes. I do, though. Himmelstoss turns to him. Tjaden, isn't it? Tjaden lifts his head. And do you know what you are? Himmelstoss is disconcerted. Since when have we become so familiar? I don't remember that we ever slept in the gutter together. He has no idea what to make of the situation. He didn't expect this open hostility. But he is on his guard. Someone has already dinned some rot into him about getting shot in the back. The question about the gutter makes Chiodin so mad that he becomes almost witty. No, you slept there by yourself. Himmelstoss begins to boil, but Chiodin gets in ahead of him. He must bring off his insult. Wouldn't you like to know what you are? A dirty hound, that's what you are. I've been wanting to tell you that for a long time. The satisfaction of months shines in his dull pig's eyes as he spits out, Dirty hound! Himmelstoss lets fly too now. What's that, you muckrake, you dirty peat-stealer? Stand up there, bring your heels together when your superior officer speaks to you. Chiodin winks solemnly. You take a run and jump at yourself, Himmelstoss. Himmelstoss is a raging book of army regulations. The Kaiser couldn't be more insulted. Tjaden, I command you as your superior officer, stand up. Anything else you would like? Asked Tjaden. Will you obey my order or not? Tjaden replies, without knowing it, in the well-known classical phrase. At the same time, he ventilates his backside. I'll have you court-martialed, storms Himmelstoss. We watch him disappear in the direction of the orderly room. Haya and Tjaden burst into a regular peat-digger's bellow. Haya laughs so much that he dislocates his jaw, and suddenly stands there helpless with his mouth wide open. Albert has to put it back again by giving it a blow with his fist. Cat is troubled. If he reports you, it'll be pretty serious. Do you think he will? Asked Tjaden. Sure to, I say. The least you'll get will be 5 days close arrest, says Cat. That doesn't worry Tjaden. 5 days clink or 5 days rest. And if they send you to the fortress, urges the thoroughgoing Muller. Well, for the time being, the war will be over, so far as I am concerned. Tjaden is a cheerful soul. There aren't any worries for him. He goes off with Haya and Lear so that they won't find him in the first flush of the excitement. Muller hasn't finished yet. He tackles Krop again. Albert, if you were really at home now, what would you do? Krop is contented now and more accommodating. How many of us were there in the class exactly? We count up. Out of 20, 7 are dead, 4 wounded, 1 in a madhouse. That makes 12 privates. 3 of them are lieutenants, says Muller. Do you think they would still let Kantrick sit on them? We guess not. We wouldn't let ourselves be sat on for that matter. What do you mean by the threefold theme in William Tell? Says Krop reminiscently and roars with laughter. What was the purpose of the Poetic League of Gudigan? Asks Muller suddenly and earnestly. How many children had Charles the Bald? I interrupt gently. You'll never make anything of your life, Balmer, croaks Muller. When was the Battle of Zana? Krop wants to know. You lack the studious mind, Krop. Sit down, 3-. I wink. What offices did Lycurgus consider the most important for the state? Asks Muller, pretending to take off his pince-nez. Does it go, we Germans fear God and none else in the whole world, or we the Germans fear God and, I submit. How many inhabitants has Melbourne? Asks Muller. How do you expect to succeed in life if you don't know that? I asked Albert hotly. Which he caps with, What is meant by cohesion? We remember mighty little of all that rubbish. Anyway, it has never been the slightest use to us. At school, nobody ever taught us how to light a cigarette in a storm of rain, nor how a fire could be made with wet wood, nor that it is best to stick a bayonet in the belly because there it doesn't get jammed, as it does in the ribs. Muller says thoughtfully, What's the use? We'll have to go back and sit on the forms again. I consider that out of the question. We might take a special exam. That needs preparation. And if you do get through, what then? A student's life isn't any better. If you have no money, you have to work like the devil. It's a bit better, but it's rot all the same, everything they teach you. Krop supports me. How can a man take all that stuff seriously when he's once been out here? Still, you must have an occupation of some sort, insists Muller, as though he were Cantric himself. Albert cleans his nails with a knife. We are surprised at this delicacy, but it is merely pensiveness. He puts the knife away and continues. That's just it. Kat and Detring and Haya will go back to their jobs because they had them already. Himmelstoss, too. But we never had any. How will we ever get used to one after this here? He makes a gesture toward the front. We'll want a private income, and then we'll be able to live by ourselves in a wood, I say, but at once feel ashamed of this absurd idea. But what will really happen when we go back? Wonders Muller, and even he is troubled. Krop gives a shrug. I don't know. Let's get back first, then we'll find out. We are all utterly at a loss. What could we do? I ask. I don't want to do anything, replies Krop wearily. You'll be dead one day, so what does it matter? I don't think we'll ever go back. When I think about it, Albert, I say after a while, rolling over on my back, when I hear the word peacetime, it goes to my head. And if it really came, I think I would do some unimaginable thing. Something, you know, that it's worth having lain here in the muck for. But I can't even imagine anything. All I do know is that this business about professions and studies and salaries and so on, it makes me sick. It is and always was disgusting. I don't see anything. I don't see anything at all, Albert. All at once, everything seems to me confused and hopeless. Krop feels it, too. It will go pretty hard with us all, but nobody at home seems to worry much about it. 2 years of shells and bombs, a man won't peel that off as easy as a sock. We agree that it's the same for everyone, not only for us here, but everywhere, for everyone who is of our age, to some more and to others less. It is the common fate of our generation. Albert expresses it. The war has ruined us for everything. He is right. We are not youth any longer. We don't want to take the world by storm. We are fleeing. We fly from ourselves, from our life. We were 18 and had begun to love life and the world, and we had to shoot it to pieces. The first bomb, the first explosion, burst in our hearts. We are cut off from activity, from striving, from progress. We believe in such things no longer. We believe in the war. The orderly room shows signs of life. Himmelstoss seems to have stirred them up. At the head of the column trots the fat sergeant major. It is queer that almost all pay sergeant majors are fat. Himmelstoss follows him, thirsting for vengeance. His boots gleam in the sun. We get up. Where's Chodden? The sergeant puffs. No one knows, of course. Himmelstoss glowers at us wrathfully. You know very well. You won't say. That's the fact of the matter. Out with it! Fatty looks round inquiringly, but Chodden is not to be seen. He tries another way. Chodden will report at the orderly room in 10 minutes, Then he steams off with Himmelstoss in his wake.
I have a feeling that next time we go up wiring, I'll be letting a bundle of wire fall on Himmelstoss's leg, hints Krop.
We'll have quite a lot of jokes with him, laughs Muller. That is our sole ambition, to knock the conceit out of a postman. I go into the hut and put Chadden wise. He disappears. Then we change our posse and lie down again to play cards. We know how to do that. To play cards, to swear, and to fight. Not much for 20 years, and yet too much for 20 years. Half an hour later, Himmelstoss is back again. Nobody pays any attention to him. He asks for Theoden. We shrug our shoulders.
Then you better find him, he persists. Haven't you been to look for him?
Krop lies back in the grass and says, Have you ever been out here before?
That's none of your business, retorts Himmelstoss. I expect an answer.
Very good, says Krop, getting up.
See up there where those little white clouds are? Those are anti-aircraft. We were over there yesterday. 5 dead and 8 wounded. It was a lot of fun. Next time, when you go up with us, before they die, the fellows will come up to you, click their heels, and ask stiffly, Please, may I go? Please, may I hop it? We've been waiting here a long time for someone like you.
He sits down again, and Himmelstoss disappears like a comet.
3 days CB, Cat conjectures. Next time, I'll let fly, I say to Albert.
But that is the end. The case comes up for trial in the evening. In the orderly room sits our lieutenant, Bertink, and calls us in one after another. I have to appear as a witness and explain the reason of Tjaden's insubordination. The story of the bedwetting makes an impression. Himmelstoss is recalled, and I repeat my statement.
Is that right? Bertink asks Himmelstoss.
He tries to evade the question, but in the end has to confess, for Krop tells the same story.
Why didn't someone report the matter then? Asks Bertink.
We are silent. He must know himself how much use it is reporting such things in the army. It isn't usual to make complaints in the army. He understands it all right, though, and lectures Himmelstoss, making it plain to him that the front isn't a parade ground. Then comes Tjaden's turn, who gets a long sermon and 3 days open arrest. He gives Krop a wink and 1 day's open arrest.
It can't be helped, he says to him regretfully. He is a decent fellow.
Open arrest is quite pleasant. The clink was once a foul house. There we can visit the prisoners. We know how to manage it. Close arrest would have met the cellar. They used to tie us to a tree, but that is forbidden now. In many ways, we are treated quite like men.
An hour after Tjaden and Krop are settled in behind their wire netting, we make our way into them.
Tjaden greets us crowing. Then we play scat far into the night. Tjaden wins, of course, the lucky wretch.
When we break up, Cat says to me, What do you say to some roast goose?
Not bad, I agree. We climb up on a munition wagon. The ride costs us 2 cigarettes. Cat has marked the spot exactly. The shed belongs to a regimental headquarters. I agree to get the goose and receive my instructions. The outhouse is behind the wall, and the door shuts with just a peg. Cat hoists me up. I rest my foot in his hands and climb over the wall. Cat keeps watch below. I wait a few moments to accustom my eyes to the darkness. Then I recognize the shed. Softly, I steal across, lift the peg, pull it out, and open the door. I distinguish 2 white patches. 2 geese, that's bad. If I grab one, the other will cackle. Well, both of them. If I'm quick, it can be done. I make a jump. I catch hold of one, and the next instant the second. Like a madman, I bash their heads against the wall to stun them. But I haven't quite enough weight. The beasts cackle and strike out with their feet and wings. I fight desperately, but Lord, what a kick a goose has! They struggle, and I stagger about. In the dark, these white patches are terrifying. My arms have grown wings,
and I'm almost afraid of going up into the sky, as though I held a couple of captive balloons in my fists. Then the row begins. One of them gets his breath and goes off like an alarm clock. Before I can do anything, something comes in from outside. I feel a blow, lie outstretched on the floor, and hear awful growls. A dog. I steal a glance to the side. He makes a snap at my throat. I lie still and tuck my chin into my collar. It's a bulldog. After an eternity, he withdraws his head and sits down beside me. But if I make the least movement, he growls. I consider. The only thing to do is to get hold of my small revolver, and that too before anyone arrives. Inch by inch, I move my hand toward it. I have the feeling that it lasts an hour. The slightest movement and then an awful growl. I lie still, then try again. When at last I have the revolver, my hand starts to tremble. I press it against the ground and then say over to myself, jerk the revolver up, fire before he has a chance to grab, and then jump up. Slowly, I take a deep breath and become calmer. Then I hold my breath, whip up the revolver. It cracks. The dog leaps howling to one side. I make for the door of the shed and fall head over heels over one of the damned geese. At full speed, I seize it again, and with a swing toss it over the wall and clamber up. No sooner am I on top than the dog is up again as lively as ever and springs at me. Quickly, I let myself drop. 10 paces away stands Cat with the goose under his arm. As soon as he sees me, we run. At last we can take a breather. The goose is dead. Cat saw to that in a moment. We intend to roast it without telling anybody. I fetch a stove and wood from the hut, and we crawl into a small deserted lean-to, which we use for such purposes. The single window space is heavily curtained. There is a sort of hearth, an iron plate set on some bricks. We kindle a fire. Cat plucks and cleans the goose. We put the feathers carefully to one side. We intend to make 2 cushions out of them with the inscription, Sleep Soft Under Shell Fire. The sound of the gunfire from the front penetrates into our refuge. The glow of the fire lights up our faces. Shadows dance on the wall. Sometimes a heavy crash and the hut shivers. Aeroplane bombs. Once we hear a stifled cry. A hut must have been hit. Aeroplanes drone. The tack-tack of machine guns breaks out, but no light that could be observed shows from us. We sit opposite one another, Cat and I, 2 soldiers in shabby coats, cooking a goose in the middle of the night. We don't talk much, but I believe we have a more complete communion with one another than even lovers have. We are 2 men, 2 minute sparks of life. Outside is the night and the circle of death. We sit on the edge of it, crouching in danger. The grease drips from our hands. In our hearts, we are close to one another, and the hour is like the room. Flecked over with the lights and shadows of our feelings cast by a quiet fire. What does he know of me, or I of him? Formerly, we should not have had a single thought in common. Now we sit with a goose between us, and feel in unison, and are so intimate that we do not even speak. It takes a long time to roast a goose, even when it is young and fat. So we take turns. One bastes it while the other lies down and sleeps. A grand smell gradually fills the hut. The noises without increase in volume, pass into my dream, and yet linger in my memory. In a half-sleep I watch Cat dip and raise the ladle. I love him, his shoulders, his angular stooping figure. And at the same time I see behind him woods and stars, and a clear voice utters words that bring me peace, to me, a soldier in big boots, belt and knapsack, taking the road that lies before him under the high heaven, quickly forgetting and seldom sorrowful, forever pressing on under the wide night sky. A little soldier and a clear voice, and if anyone were to caress him, he would hardly understand. This soldier with the big boots and shut heart, who marches because he is wearing big boots and has forgotten all else but marching. Beyond the skyline is a country with flowers, lying so still that he would like to weep. There are sights there that he has not forgotten, because he never possessed them, perplexing yet lost to him. Are not his 20 summers there? Is my face wet, and where am I? Cat stands before me, his gigantic, stooping shadow falls upon me like home. He speaks gently, he smiles and goes back to the fire. Then he says, "It's done." "Yes, Cat." I stir myself. In the middle of the room shines the brown goose. We take out our collapsible forks and our pocket knives and each cuts off a leg. With it we have army bread dipped in gravy. We eat slowly and with gusto. "How does it taste, Cat?"
"Good. And yours?"
"Good, Cat." We are brothers and press on one another the choicest pieces. Afterwards I smoke a cigarette and Cat a cigar. There is still a lot left. "How would it be, Cat, if we took a bit to Krop and Tjaden?"
"Sure," says he.
We carve off a portion and wrap it up carefully in newspaper. The rest we thought of taking over to the hut. Cat laughs and simply says, "Tjaden." I agree, we'll have to take it all. So we go off to the fowl house to wake them. But first we pack away the feathers. Krop and Tjaden take us for magicians. Then they get busy with their teeth. Tjaden holds a wing in his mouth with both hands like a mouth organ and gnaws. He drinks the gravy from the pot and smacks his lips. "May I never forget you!" We go to our hut. Again there is the lofty sky with the stars and the oncoming dawn, and I pass on beneath it, a soldier with big boots and a full belly, a little soldier in the early morning. But by my side, stooping and angular, goes Cat, my comrade. The outlines of the huts are upon us in the dawn like a dark, deep sleep. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque, translated by Arthur Wesley Ween. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 6. There are rumors of an offensive. We go up to the front 2 days earlier than usual. On the way, we pass a shelled schoolhouse. Stacked up against its longer side is a high double wall of yellow, unpolished, brand-new coffins. They still smell of fir and pine and the forest. There are at least 100. "That's a good preparation for the offensive," says Muller, astonished. "They're for us," growls Dettering. "Don't talk rot," says Cat to him angrily. "You be thankful if you get so much as a coffin," grins Tjaden. "They'll slip you a waterproof sheet for your old Aunt Sally of a carcass." The others jest too, unpleasant jests, but what else can a man do? The coffins are really for us. The organization surpasses itself in that kind of thing. Ahead of us everything is simmering. The first night we try to get our bearings. When it is fairly quiet we can hear the transports behind the enemy lines rolling ceaselessly until dawn. Cat says they do not go back but are bringing up troops, munitions, and shells. The English artillery has been strengthened, that we can detect at once. There are at least 4 more batteries of 25s to the right of the farm, and behind the poplars they have put in trench mortars. Besides these, they have brought up a number of those little French beasts with instantaneous fuses. We are in low spirits. After we have been in the dugouts 2 hours, our own shells begin to fall in the trench. This is the third time in 4 weeks. If it were simply a mistake in aim, no one would say anything. But the truth is that the barrels are worn out. The shots are often so uncertain that they land within our own lines. Tonight 2 of our men were wounded by them. The front is a cage in which we must await fearfully whatever may happen. We lie under the network of arching shells and live in a suspense of uncertainty. Over us chance hovers. If a shot comes, we can duck, that is all. We neither know nor can determine where it will fall. It is this chance that makes us indifferent. A few months ago, I was sitting in a dugout playing scat. After a while, I stood up and went to visit some friends in another dugout. On my return, nothing more was to be seen of the first one. It had been blown to pieces by a direct hit. I went back to the second and arrived just in time to lend a hand digging it out. In the interval, it had been buried. It is just as much a matter of chance that I am still alive as that I might have been hit. In a bomb-proof dugout, I may be smashed to atoms, and in the open may survive 10 hours' bombardment unscathed. No soldier outlives 1,000 chances, but every soldier believes in chance and trusts his luck. We must look out for our bread. The rats have become much more numerous lately because the trenches are no longer in good condition. Dettering says it is a sure sign of a coming bombardment. The rats here are particularly repulsive. They are so fat, the kind we call corpse rats. They have shocking, evil, naked faces, and it is nauseating to see their long, nude tails. They seem to be mighty hungry. Almost every man has had his bread gnawed. Crop wrapped his in his waterproof sheet and put it under his head, but he cannot sleep because they run over his face to get at it. Dettering meant to outwit them. He fastened a thin wire to the roof and suspended his bread from it. During the night, when he switched on his pocket torch, he saw the wire swinging to and fro. On the bread was riding a fat rat. At last we put a stop to it. We cannot afford to throw the bread away because already we have practically nothing left to eat in the morning, so we carefully cut off the bits of bread that the animals have gnawed. The slices we cut off are heaped together in the middle of the floor. Each man takes out his spade and lies down prepared to strike. Dettering, Crop, and Cat hold their pocket lamps ready. After a few minutes, we hear the first shuffling and tugging. It grows. Now it is the sound of many little feet. Then the torches switch on, and every man strikes at the heap, which scatters with a rush. The result is good. We toss the bits of rat over the parapet and again lie in wait. Several times we repeat the process. At last the beasts get wise to it, or perhaps they have scented the blood. They return no more. Nevertheless, before morning, the remainder of the bread on the floor has been carried off. In the adjoining sector, they attacked 2 large cats and a dog, bit them to death, and devoured them. Next day there is an issue of Edamer cheese. Each man gets almost 1/4 of a cheese. In one way, that is all to the good, for Edamer is tasty, but in another way it is vile, because the fat red balls have long been a sign of a bad time coming. Our forebodings increase as rum is served out. We drink it, of course, but are not greatly comforted. For days we loaf about and make war on the rats. Ammunition and hand grenades become more plentiful. We even overhaul the bayonets, that is to say, the ones that have a saw on the blunt edge. If the fellows over there catch a man with one of those, he's killed at sight. In the next sector, some of our men were found whose noses were cut off and their eyes poked out with their own saw bayonets. Their mouths and noses were stuffed with sawdust so that they suffocated. Some of the recruits have bayonets of this kind. We take them away and give them the ordinary kind. But the bayonet has practically lost its importance. It is usually the fashion now to charge with bombs and spades only. The sharpened spade is a more handy and many-sided weapon. Not only can it be used for jabbing a man under the chin, but it is much better for striking with because of its greater weight, and if one hits between the neck and shoulder, it easily cleaves as far down as the chest. The bayonet frequently jams on the thrust, and then a man has to kick hard on the other fellow's belly to pull it out again, and in the interval he may easily get one himself. and what's more, the blade often gets broken off. At night, they send over gas. We expect the attack to follow and lie with our masks on, ready to tear them off as soon as the first shadow appears. Dawn approaches without anything happening, only the everlasting, nerve-wracking roll behind the enemy lines. Trains, trains, lorries, lorries. But what are they concentrating? Our artillery fires on it continually, but still it does not cease. We have tired faces and avoid each other's eyes. "It will be like the Somme," says Cat gloomily. "There we were shelled steadily for 7 days and nights." Cat has lost all his fun since we have been here, which is bad, for Cat is an old front hog and can smell what is coming. Only Tjaden seems pleased with the good rations and the rum. He thinks we might even go back to rest without anything happening at all. It almost looks like it. Day after day passes. At night, I squat in the listening post. Above me, the rockets and parachute lights shoot up and float down again. I am cautious and tense. My heart thumps. My eyes turn again and again to the luminous dial of my watch. The hands will not budge. Sleep hangs on my eyelids. I work my toes in my boots in order to keep awake. Nothing happens till I am relieved. Only the everlasting rolling over there. Gradually, we grow calmer and play scat and poker continually. Perhaps we will be lucky. All day the sky is hung with observation balloons. There is a rumor that the enemy are going to put tanks over and use low-flying planes for the attack. But that interests us less than what we hear of the new flamethrowers. We wake up in the middle of the night. The earth booms. Heavy fire is falling on us. We crouch into corners. We distinguish shells of every caliber. Each man lays hold of his things and looks again every minute to reassure himself that they are still there. The dugout heaves, the night roars and flashes. We look at each other in the momentary flashes of light, and with pale faces and pressed lips shake our heads. Every man is aware of the heavy shells tearing down the parapet, rooting up the embankment and demolishing the upper layers of concrete. When a shell lands in the trench, we note how the hollow, furious blast is like a blow from the paw of a raging beast of prey. Already by morning, a few of the recruits are green and vomiting. They are too inexperienced. Slowly, the gray light trickles into the post and pales the flashes of the shells. Morning has come. The explosion of mines mingles with the gunfire. That is the most dementing convulsion of all. The whole region where they go up becomes one grave. The reliefs go out, the observers stagger in, covered with dirt and trembling. One lies down in silence in the corner and eats. The other, a reservist reinforcement, sobs. Twice he has been flung over the parapet by the blast of the explosions, without getting any more than shell shock. The recruits are eyeing him. We must watch them. These things are catching. Already some lips begin to quiver. It is good that it is growing daylight. Perhaps the attack will come before noon. The bombardment does not diminish. It is falling in the rear, too. As far as one can see, it spouts fountains of mud and iron. A wide belt is being raked. The attack does not come, but the bombardment continues. Slowly, we become mute. Hardly a man speaks. We cannot make ourselves understood. Our trench is almost gone. At many places, it is only 18 inches high. It is broken by holes and craters and mountains of earth. A shell lands square in front of our post. At once, it is dark. We are buried and must dig ourselves out. After an hour, the entrance is clear again, and we are calmer, because we have had something to do. Our company commander scrambles in and reports that two dugouts are gone. The recruits calm themselves when they see him. He says that an attempt will be made to bring up food this evening. That sounds reassuring. No one had thought of it except Tjaden. Now the outside world seems to draw a little nearer. If food can be brought up, think the recruits, then it can't really be so bad. We do not disabuse them. We know that food is as important as ammunition, and only for that reason must be brought up. But it miscarries. A second party goes out, and it also turns back. Finally, Cat tries, and even he reappears without accomplishing anything. No one gets through. Not even a fly is small enough to get through such a barrage. We pull in our belts tighter and chew every mouthful three times as long. Still, the food does not last out. We are damnably hungry. I take out a scrap of bread, eat the white, and put the crust back in my knapsack. From time to time, I nibble at it. The night is unbearable. We cannot sleep, but stare ahead of us and doze. Tjaden regrets that we wasted the gnawed pieces of bread on the rats. We would gladly have them again to eat now. We are short of water, too, but not seriously yet. Towards morning, while it is still dark, there is some excitement. Through the entrance rushes in a swarm of fleeing rats that try to storm the walls. Torches light up the confusion. Everyone yells and curses and slaughters. The madness and despair of many hours unloads itself in this outburst. Faces are distorted, arms strike out, the beasts scream. We just stop in time to avoid attacking one another. The onslaught has exhausted us. We lie down to wait again. It is a marvel that our post has had no casualties so far. It is one of the few deep dugouts. A corporal creeps in. He has a loaf of bread with him. Three people have had the luck to get through during the night and bring some provisions. They say the bombardment extends undiminished as far as the artillery lines. It is a mystery where the enemy gets all his shells. We wait and wait. By midday, what I expected happens. One of the recruits has a fit. I have been watching him for a long time, grinding his teeth and opening and shutting his fists. These hunted, protruding eyes, we know them too well. During the last few hours, he has had merely the appearance of calm. He had collapsed like a rotten tree. Now he stands up, stealthily creeps across the floor, hesitates a moment, and then glides towards the door. I intercept him and say, "Where are you going?" "I'll be back in a minute," says he, and tries to push past me. "Wait a bit. The shelling will stop soon." He listens, and for a moment his eye becomes clear. Then again he has the glowering eyes of a mad dog. He is silent. He shoves me aside. "1 minute, lad," I say. Cat notices. Just as the recruit shakes me off, Cat jumps in, and we hold him. Then he begins to rave. "Leave me alone! Let me go out! I will go out!" He won't listen to anything and hits out. His mouth is wet and pours out words, half-choked, meaningless words. It is a case of claustrophobia. He feels as though he is suffocating here and wants to get out at any price. If we let him go, he would run about everywhere regardless of cover. He is not the first. Though he raves and his eyes roll, it can't be helped. We have to give him a hiding to bring him to his senses. We do it quickly and mercilessly, and at last he sits down quietly. The others have turned pale. Let's hope it deters them. This bombardment is too much for the poor devils. They have been sent straight from a recruiting depot into a barrage that is enough to turn an old soldier's hair gray. After this affair, the sticky, close atmosphere works more than ever on our nerves. We sit as if in our graves, waiting only to be closed in. Suddenly, it howls and flashes terrifically. The dugout cracks in all its joints under a direct hit. Fortunately, only a light one that the concrete blocks are able to withstand. It rings metallically, the walls reel,
Rifles, helmets, earth, mud, and dust fly everywhere. Sulfur fumes pour in. If we were in one of those light dugouts that they have been building lately instead of this deep one, not one of us would now be alive. But the effect is bad enough even so. The recruit starts to rave again, and two others follow suit. One jumps up and rushes out. We have trouble with the other two. I start after the one who escapes, and wonder whether to shoot him in the leg. Then it shrieks again. I fling myself down, and when I stand up, the wall of the trench is plastered with smoking splinters, lumps of flesh, and bits of uniform. I scramble back. The first recruit seems actually to have gone insane. He butts his head against the wall like a goat. We must try tonight to take him to the rear. Meanwhile, we bind him, but in such a way that in case of attack he can be released at once. Cat suggests a game of scat. It is easier when a man has something to do. But it is no use. We listen for every explosion that comes close, miscount the tricks, and fail to follow suit. We have to give it up. We sit as though in a hissing boiler that is being belabored from without on all sides. Night again. We are deadened by the strain, a deadly tension that scrapes along one's spine like a gapped knife. Our legs refuse to move, our hands tremble, our bodies are a thin skin stretched painfully over repressed madness, over an almost irresistible bursting roar. We have neither flesh nor muscles any longer. We dare not look at one another for fear of some incalculable thing. So we shut our teeth. It will end. It will end. Perhaps we will come through. Suddenly, the near explosions cease. The shelling continues, but it has lifted and falls behind us. Our trench is free. We seize the hand grenades, pitch them out in front of the dugout, and jump after them. The bombardment has stopped, and a heavy barrage now falls behind us. The attack has come. No one would believe that in this howling waste there could still be men, but steel helmets now appear on all sides out of the trench, and 50 yards from us a machine gun is already in position and barking. The wire entanglements are torn to pieces, yet they offer some obstacle. We see the stormtroops coming. Our artillery opens fire. Machine guns rattle, rifles crack. The charge works its way across. Haya and Krop begin with the hand grenades. They throw as fast as they can. Others pass them, the handles with the strings already pulled. Haya throws 75 yards, Krop 60. It has been measured. The distance is important. The enemy, as they run, cannot do much before they are within 40 yards. We recognize the distorted faces, the smooth helmets. They are French. They have already suffered heavily when they reach the remnants of the barbed wire entanglements. A whole line has gone down before our machine guns. Then we have a lot of stoppages, and they come nearer. I see one of them, his face upturned, fall into a wire cradle. His body collapses. His hands remain suspended, as though he were praying. Then his body drops clean away, and only his hands with the stumps of his arms, shot off, now hang in the wire. The moment we are about to retreat, three faces rise up from the ground in front of us. Under one of the helmets, a dark pointed beard and two eyes that are fastened on me. I raise my hand, but I cannot throw into those strange eyes. For one mad moment, the whole slaughter whirls like a circus round me, and these two eyes that are alone motionless. Then the head rises up, a hand, a movement, and my hand grenade flies through the air and into him. We make for the rear, pull wire cradles into the trench, and leave bombs behind us with the string pulled, which ensure us a fiery retreat. The machine guns are already firing from the next position. We have become wild beasts. We do not fight, we defend ourselves against annihilation. It is not against men that we fling our bombs. What do we know of men in this moment when death with hands and helmets is hunting us down? Now, for the first time in 3 days, we can see his face. Now, for the first time in 3 days, we can oppose him. We feel a mad anger.
No longer do we lie helpless, waiting on the scaffold. We can destroy and kill to save ourselves and be revenged. We crouch behind every corner, behind every barrier of barbed wire, and hurl heaps of explosives at the feet of the advancing enemy before we run. The blast of the hand grenades impinges powerfully on our arms and legs. Crouching like cats, we run on, overwhelmed by this wave that bears us along, that fills us with ferocity, turning us into thugs, into murderers, into God only knows what devils. This wave that multiplies our strength with fear and madness and greed of life, seeking and fighting for nothing but our deliverance. If your own father came over with them, you would not hesitate to fling a bomb into him. The forward trenches have been abandoned. Are they still trenches? They are blown to pieces, annihilated. There are only broken bits of trenches, holes linked by tracks, nests of craters, that is all. But the enemy's casualties increase. They did not count on so much resistance. It is nearly noon. The sun blazes hotly. The sweat stings in our eyes. We wipe it off on our sleeves, and often blood with it. At last we reach a trench that is in a somewhat better condition. It is manned and ready for the counterattack. It receives us. Our guns open up in full blast and cut off the enemy attack. The lines behind us stop. They can advance no farther. The attack is crushed by our artillery. We watch. The fire lifts 100 yards, and we break forward. Beside me, a lance corporal has his head torn off. He runs a few steps more while the blood spouts from his neck like a fountain. It does not come quite to hand-to-hand fighting. They are driven back. We arrive once again at our shattered trench and pass on beyond it. Oh, this turning back again! We reach the shelter of the reserves and yearn to creep in and disappear, but instead we must turn round and plunge again into the horror. If we were not automata at that moment, we would continue lying there, exhausted and without will. But we are swept forward again, powerless, madly savage and raging. We will kill, for they are still our mortal enemies. Their rifles and bombs are aimed against us. And if we don't destroy them, they will destroy us. The brown earth, the torn blasted earth, with a greasy shine under the sun's rays. The earth is the background of this restless, gloomy world of automatons. Our gasping is the scratching of a quill. Our lips are dry, our heads are debauched with stupor. Thus we stagger forward, and into our pierced and shattered souls bores the tutoring image of the brown earth with the greasy sun and the convulsed and dead soldiers who lie there, it can't be helped, who cry and clutch at our legs as we spring away over them. We have lost all feeling for one another. We can hardly control ourselves when our hunted glance lights on the form of some other man. We are insensible, dead men, who through some trick, some dreadful magic, are still able to run and to kill. A young Frenchman lags behind. He is overtaken. He puts up his hands. In one he still holds his revolver. Does he mean to shoot or to give himself up? A blow from a spade cleaves through his face. A second sees it and tries to run farther. A bayonet jabs into his back. He leaps in the air, his arms thrown wide, his mouth wide open, yelling. He staggers. In his back the bayonet quivers. A third throws away his rifle, cowers down with his hands before his eyes. He is left behind with a few other prisoners to carry off the wounded. Suddenly in the pursuit we reach the enemy line. We are so close on the heels of our retreating enemies that we reach it almost at the same time as they. In this way we suffer few casualties. A machine gun barks, but is silenced with a bomb. Nevertheless, the couple of seconds has sufficed to give us 5 stomach wounds. With the butt of his rifle, Katz smashes to pulp the face of one of the unwounded machine gunners. We bayonet the others before they have time to get out their bombs. Then thirstily we drink the water they have for cooling the gun. Everywhere wire cutters are snapping, Planks are thrown across the entanglements. We jump through the narrow entrances and into the trenches. Hyas strikes his spade into the neck of a gigantic Frenchman and throws the first hand grenade. We duck behind a breastwork for a few seconds. Then the whole section of the trench before us is empty. The next throw whizzes obliquely over the corner and clears a passage. As we run past, we toss handfuls down into the dugouts. The earth shudders. It crashes, dully and stifled. We stumble over slippery lumps of flesh, over yielding bodies. I fall into an open belly on which lies a clean, new officer's cap. The fight ceases. We lose touch with the enemy. We cannot stay here long, but must retire under cover of our artillery to our own position. No sooner do we know this than we dive into the nearest dugouts, and with the utmost haste seize on whatever provisions we can see, especially the tins of corned beef and butter, before we clear out. We get back pretty well. There has been no further attack by the enemy. We lie for an hour panting and resting before anyone speaks. We are so completely played out that in spite of our great hunger we do not think of the provisions. Then, gradually, we become something like men again. The corned beef over there is famous along the whole front. Occasionally, it has been the chief reason for a flying raid on our part, for our nourishment is generally very bad. We have a constant hunger. We bagged 5 tins altogether. The fellows over there are well looked after. It seems a luxury to us with our hunger pangs, our turnip jam, and meat so scarce that we simply grab at it. Haya has scored a thin loaf of white French bread and stuck it in behind his belt like a spade. It is a bit bloody at one corner, but that can be cut off. It is a good thing we have something decent to eat at last. We still have a use for all our strength. Enough to eat is just as valuable as a good dugout. It can save our lives. That is the reason we are so greedy for it. Chaden has captured 2 water bottles full of cognac. We pass them round. The evening benediction begins. Night comes. Out of the craters rise the mists. It looks as though the holes were full of ghostly secrets. The white vapor creeps painfully round before it ventures to steal away over the edge. Then long streaks stretch from crater to crater. It is chilly. I am on sentry and stare into the darkness. My strength is exhausted, as always, after an attack, so it is hard for me to be alone with my thoughts. They are not properly thoughts. They are memories which in my weakness turn homeward and strangely move me. The parachute lights shoot upwards, and I see a picture, a summer evening. I am in the cathedral cloister and look at the tall rose trees that bloom in the middle of the little cloister garden where the monks lie buried. Around the walls are the stone carvings of the Stations of the Cross. No one is there. A great quietness rules in this blossoming quadrangle. The sun lies warm on the heavy gray stones. I place my hand upon them and feel the warmth. At the right-hand corner, the green cathedral spire ascends into the pale blue sky of the evening. Between the glowing columns of the cloister is the cool darkness that only churches have, and I stand there and wonder whether, when I am 20, I shall have experienced the bewildering emotions of love. The image is alarmingly near. It touches me before it dissolves in the light of the next star shell. I lay hold of my rifle to see that it is in trim. The barrel is wet. I take it in my hand and rub off the moisture with my fingers. Between the meadows behind our town there stands a line of old poplars by a stream. They were visible from a great distance, and although they grew on one bank only, we called them the Poplar Avenue. Even as children we had a great love for them. They drew us vaguely thither. We played truant the whole day by them and listened to their rustling. We sat beneath them on the bank of the stream and let our feet hang over in the bright, swift waters. The pure fragrance of the water and the melody of the wind in the poplars held our fancies. We loved them dearly, and the image of those days still makes my heart pause in its beating. It is strange that all the memories that come have these two qualities. They are always completely calm. That is predominant in them. And even if they are not really calm, they become so. They are soundless apparitions that speak to me, with looks and gestures, silently, without any word. And it is the alarm of their silence that forces me to lay hold of my sleeve and my rifle, lest I should abandon myself to the liberation and allurement in which my body would dilate and gently pass away into the still forces that lie behind these things. They are quiet in this way because quietness is so unattainable for us now. At the front there is no quietness, and the curse of the front reaches so far that we never pass beyond it. Even in the remote depots and rest areas, the droning and the muffled noise of shelling is always in our ears. We are never so far off that it is no more to be heard. But these last few days it has been unbearable. Their stillness is the reason why these memories of former times do not awaken desire so much as sorrow, a strange, inapprehensible melancholy. Once we had such desires, but they return not. They are past. They belong to another world that is gone from us. In the barracks they called forth a rebellious, wild craving for their return. For then they were still bound to us. We belonged to them, and they to us, even though we were already absent from them. They appeared in the soldiers' songs, which we sang as we marched between the glow of the dawn and the black silhouettes of the forests to drill on the moor. They were a powerful remembrance that was in us and came from us. But here in the trenches they are completely lost to us. They arise no more. We are dead, and they stand remote on the horizon. They are an apparition, a mysterious reflection drawing us home, that we fear and love without hope. They are strong, and our desire is strong, but they are unattainable, and we know it. And even if these scenes of our youth were given back to us, we would hardly know what to do. The tender, secret influence that passed from them into us could not arise again. We long to be in them and to move in them. We long to remember and to love them and to be stirred by the sight of them. But it would be like gazing at the photograph of a dead comrade. Those are his features, it is his face, and the days we spent together take on a mournful life in the memory, but the man himself it is not. We could never again, as the same beings, take part in those scenes. It was not any recognition of their beauty and their significance that attracted us, but the communion, the feeling of a comradeship with the things and events of our existence, which cut us off and made the world of our parents a thing incomprehensible to us. For then we surrendered ourselves to events and were lost in them, and the least little thing was enough to carry us down the stream of eternity. Perhaps it was only the privilege of our youth, but as yet we recognized no limits and saw nowhere an end. We had that thrill of expectation in the blood which united us with the course of our days. Today we would pass through the senses of our youth like travelers. We are burnt up by hard facts. Like tradesmen we understand distinctions, and like butchers, necessities. We are no longer untroubled, we are indifferent. We long to be there, but could we live there? We are forlorn like children, and experienced like old men. We are crude and sorrowful and superficial. I believe we are lost. My hands grow cold and my flesh creeps, and yet the night is warm. Only the mist is cold, this mysterious mist that trails the dead before us and sucks from them their past, creeping life. By morning they will be pale and green and their blood congealed and black. Still the parachute rockets shoot up and cast their pitiless light over the stony landscape, which is full of craters and frozen lights like a moon. The blood beneath my skin brings fear and restlessness into my thoughts. They become feeble and tremble. They desire warmth and life. They cannot endure without sympathy and communion. They are disordered before the naked picture of despair. I hear the rattle of the mess tins and immediately feel a strong desire for warm food. It would do me good and comfort me. Painfully, I force myself to wait until I am relieved. Then I go into the dugout and find a mug of barley. It is cooked in fat and tastes good. I eat it slowly. I remain quiet, though the others are in a better mood, for the shelling has died down. The days go by, and the incredible hours follow one another as a matter of course. Attacks alternate with counterattacks, and slowly the dead pile up in the field of craters between the trenches. We are able to bring in most of the wounded that do not lie too far off, but many have long to wait, and we listen to them dying. For one of them we search 2 days in vain. He must be lying on his belly and unable to turn over. Otherwise, it is hard to understand why we cannot find him, for it is only when a man has his mouth close to the ground that it is impossible to gauge the direction of his cry. He must have been badly hit, one of those nasty wounds, neither so severe that they exhaust the body at once and a man dreams on in a half-swoon, nor so light that a man endures the pain in the hope of becoming well again. Cat thinks he has either a broken pelvis or a shot through the spine. His chest cannot have been injured, otherwise he would not have such strength to cry out. And if it were any other kind of wound, it would be possible to see him moving. He grows gradually hoarser. The voice sounds so desperate that it prevails everywhere. The first night, some of our fellows go out 3 times to look for him. But when they think they have located him and crawl across, next time they hear the voice, it seems to come from somewhere else altogether. We search in vain until dawn. We scrutinize the field all day with glasses, but discover nothing. On the second day, the calls are fainter. That will be because his lips and mouth have become dry. Our company commander has promised special leave with 3 days extra to anyone who finds him. That is a powerful inducement, but we would do all that is possible without that, for his cry is terrible. Cat and Crop even go out in the afternoon, and Albert gets the lobe of his ear shot off in consequence. It is to no purpose. They come back without him. It is easy to understand what he cries. At first he called only for help. The second night he must have some delirium. He talks with his wife and his children. We often detect the name Elise. Today he merely weeps. By evening the voice dwindles to a croaking. But it persists still through the whole night. We hear it so distinctly because the wind blows toward our line. In the morning, when we suppose he must already have long gone to his rest, there comes across to us one last gurgling rattle. The days are hot and the dead lie unburied. We cannot fetch them all in. If we did, we should not know what to do with them. The shells will bury them. Many have their bellies swollen up like balloons. They hiss, belch, and make movements. The gases in them make noises. The sky is blue and without clouds. In the evening it grows sultry, and the heat rises from the earth. When the wind blows toward us, it brings the smell of blood, which is heavy and sweet. This deathly exhalation from the shell holes seems to be a mixture of chloroform and putrefaction, and fills us with nausea and retching. The nights become quiet, and the hunt for copper driving bands and the silken parachutes of the French star shells begins. Why the driving bands are so desirable, no one knows exactly. The collectors merely assert that they are valuable. Some have collected so many that they will stoop under the weight of them when we go back. But Haya at least gives a reason. He intends to give them to his girl to supplement her garters. At this, the Frisians explode with mirth. They slap their knees. By Jove, though, he's a wit, Haya is. He's got brains. Tiadin especially can hardly contain himself. He takes the largest of the rings in his hand and every now and then puts his leg through it to show how much slack there is. Haya, man, she must have legs like... legs? His thoughts mount somewhat higher. And a behind, too. She must have like a... like an elephant. He cannot get over it. I wish I could play hot hand with her once, my hat.
Haya beams, proud that his girl should receive so much appreciation.
She's a nice bit, he says with self-satisfaction.
The parachutes are turned to more practical uses. According to the size of the bust, three or perhaps four will make a blouse. Crop and I use them as handkerchiefs. The others send them home. If the women could see at what risk these bits of rag are often obtained, they would be horrified.
Cat surprises Chaden, endeavoring with perfect equanimity to knock the driving band off a dud. If anyone else had tried it, the thing would have exploded, but Chaden always has his luck with him.
One morning, two butterflies play in front of our trench. They are brimstone butterflies, with red spots on their yellow wings. What can they be looking for here? There is not a plant nor a flower for miles. They settle on the teeth of a skull. The birds, too, are just as carefree. They have long since accustomed themselves to the war. Every morning, larks ascend from no man's land. A year ago, we watched them nesting. The young ones grew up, too.
We have a spell from the rats in the trench. They are in no man's land. We know what for. They grow fat. When we see one, we have a crack at it. At night, we hear again the rolling behind the enemy lines. All day, we have only the normal shelling, so that we are able to repair the trenches. There is always plenty of amusement, the airmen see to that. There are countless fights for us to watch every day.
Battle planes don't trouble us, but the observation plans we hate like the plague. They put the artillery on to us. A couple of minutes after they appear, shrapnel and high explosives begin to drop on us. We lose 11 men in one day that way, and five of them stretcher-bearers. Two are so smashed that Tiaden remarks you could scrape them off the wall of the trench with a spoon and bury them in a mess tin. Another has the lower part of his body and his legs torn off. Dead, his chest leans against the side of the trench. His face is lemon yellow. In his beard still burns a cigarette. It glows until it dies out on his lips. We put the dead in a large shell hole. So far, there are three layers, one on top of the other. Suddenly, the shelling begins to pound again. Soon we are sitting up once more with the rigid tenseness of blank anticipation. Attack, counterattack, charge, repulse. These are words, but what things they signified. We have lost a good many men, mostly recruits. Reinforcements have again been sent up to our sector. It is one of the new regiments, composed of young fellows called up during last year. They have had hardly any training, and are sent into the field with only a theoretical knowledge. They do know what a hand grenade is, it is true, but they have very little idea of cover, and what is most important of all, have no eye for it. A fold in the ground has to be quite 18 inches high before they can see it. Although we need reinforcement, the recruits give us almost more trouble than they are worth. They are helpless in this grim fighting area. They fall like flies. The present method of fighting from posts demands knowledge and experience. A man must have a feeling for the contours of the ground, an ear for the sound and character of the shells, must be able to decide beforehand where they will drop, how they will burst, and how to shelter from them. The young recruits, of course, know none of these things. They get killed simply because they can hardly tell shrapnel from high explosive. They are mown down because they are listening anxiously to the roar of the big coal boxes falling far in the rear, and miss the light, piping whistle of the low-spreading little daisy cutters. They flock together like sheep instead of scattering, and even the wounded are shot down like hares by the airmen. Their pale turnip faces, their pitiful clenched hands, the miserable courage of these poor devils, the desperate charges and attacks made by these poor brave devils, who are so terrified that they dare not cry out loudly, but with battered chests and torn bellies and arms and legs, only whimper softly for their mothers and cease as soon as one looks at them. Their sharp, downy, dead faces have the awful expressionlessness of dead children. It brings a lump into the throat to see how they go over and run and fall.
a man would like to spank them, they are so stupid, and to take them by the arm and lead them away from here where they have no business to be. They wear gray coats and trousers and boots, but for most of them the uniform is far too big. It hangs on their limbs, their shoulders are too narrow, their bodies too slight. No uniform was ever made to these childish measurements. Between 5 and 10 recruits fall to every old hand. A surprise gas attack carries off a lot of them. They have not yet learned what to do. We found one dugout full of them, with blue heads and black lips. Some of them in a shell hole took their masks off too soon. They did not know that the gas lies longest in the hollows. When they saw others on top without masks, they pulled theirs off too, and swallowed enough to scorch their lungs. Their condition is hopeless. They choke to death with hemorrhages and suffocation. In one part of the trench, I suddenly run into Himmelstoss. We dive into the same dugout. Breathless, we are all lying one beside the other, waiting for the charge. When we run out again, although I am very excited, I suddenly think, "Where's Himmelstoss?" Quickly, I jump back into the dugout and find him with a small scratch lying in a corner pretending to be wounded. His face looks sullen. He is in a panic. He is new to it, too. But it makes me mad that the young recruit should be out there and he here. "Get out," I spit. He does not stir. His lips quiver. His mustache twitches. "Out," I repeat. He draws up his legs, crouches back against the wall, and shows his teeth like a cur. I seize him by the arm and try to pull him up. He barks. That is too much for me. I grab him by the neck and shake him like a sack. His head jerks from side to side. "You lump, will you get out? You hound, you skunk, sneak out of it, would you?" His eye becomes glassy. I knock his head against the wall. "You cow!" I kick him in the ribs. "You swine!" I push him toward the door and shove him out head first. Another wave of our attack has just come up. A lieutenant is with them. He sees us and yells, "Forward! Forward! Join in! Follow!" And the word of command does what all my banging could not. Himmelstoss hears the order, looks round him as if awakened, and follows on. I come after and watch him go over. Once more he is the smart Himmelstoss of the parade ground. He has even outstripped the lieutenant and is far ahead. Bombardment, barrage, curtain fire, mines, gas, tanks, machine guns, hand grenades, words, words, but they hold the horror of the world. Our faces are encrusted, our thoughts are devastated, we are weary to death. When the attack comes, we shall have to strike many of the men with our fists to waken them and make them come with us. Our eyes are burnt, our hands are torn, our knees bleed, our elbows are raw. How long has it been? Weeks, months, years? Only days. We see time pass in the colorless faces of the dying. We cram food into us. We run, we throw, we shoot, we kill, we lie about. We are feeble and spent, and nothing supports us but the knowledge that there are still feebler, still more spent, still more helpless ones there, who, with staring eyes, look upon us as gods that escape death many times. In the few hours of rest, we teach them. "There, see that waggle top? That's a mortar coming. Keep down, it will go clean over. But if it comes this way, then run for it. You can run from a mortar." We sharpen their ears to the malicious, hardly audible buzz of the smaller shells that are not so easily distinguished. They must pick them out from the general din by their insect-like hum. We explain to them that these are far more dangerous than the big ones that can be heard long beforehand. We show them how to take cover from aircraft, how to simulate a dead man when one is overrun in an attack, how to time hand grenades so that they explode half a second before hitting the ground. We teach them to fling themselves into holes as quick as lightning before the shells with instantaneous fuses. We show them how to clean up a trench with a handful of bombs. We explain the difference between the fuse length of the enemy bombs and our own. we put them wise to the sound of gas shells, show them all the tricks that can save them from death. They listen, they are docile, but when it begins again, in their excitement, they do everything wrong.
Hyavestus drags off with a great wound in his back through which the lung pulses at every breath. I can only press his hand.
"It's all up, Paul," he groans and bites his arm because of the pain.
We see men living with their skulls blown open. We see soldiers run with their 2 feet cut off. They stagger on their splintered stumps into the next shell hole. A lance corporal crawls a mile and a half on his hands, dragging his smashed knee after him. Another goes to the dressing station, and over his clasped hands bulge his intestines. We see men without mouths, without jaws, without faces. We find one man who has held the artery of his arm in his teeth for 2 hours in order not to bleed to death. The sun goes down, night comes, the shells whine, life is at an end. Still, the little piece of convulsed earth in which we lie is held. We have yielded no more than a few hundred yards of it as a prize to the enemy. But on every yard there lies a dead man. We have been relieved. The wheels roll beneath us, we stand dully, and when the call, "Mind, wire," comes, we bend our knees. It was summer when we came up. The trees were still green. Now it is autumn, and the night is gray and wet. The lorries stop. We climb out. A confused heap, a remnant of many names. On either side stand people, dark, calling out the numbers of the regiments, the companies. And at each call a little group separates itself off, a small handful of dirty, pallid soldiers, a dreadfully small handful, and a dreadfully small remnant. Now someone is calling the number of our company. It is, yes, the company commander. He has got one, too. His arm is in a sling. We go over to him, and I recognize Cat and Albert. We stand together, lean against each other, and look at one another. And we hear the number of our company called again and again. He will call a long time. They do not hear him in the hospitals and the shell holes. Once again, "Second company, this way." And then, more softly, "Nobody else, second company?" He is silent, and then huskily he says, "Is that all?" and gives the order, "Number." The morning is gray. It was still summer when we came up, and we were 150 strong. Now we freeze. It is autumn. The leaves rustle. The voices flutter out wearily. "One, two, three, four," and cease at 32. And there is a long silence before the voice asks, "Anyone else?" And waits, and then says softly, "In squads," and then breaks off and is only able to finish, "Second company," with difficulty, "Second company, march easy." A line, a short line, trudges off into the morning. 32 men. End of chapter 6.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. with digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.